Hello and welcome to Blockchain Gaming World episode 159. I'm your host, John Jordan. Don't forget to check out my daily email about what's going on in the world of blockchain games. You can find that at gamestx.substack.com. In today's episode, I'm talking to Yat Su, who is the chairman of Animoca Brands. It's the third time Yat has been on the podcast. I always have a fantastic time talking to him. In this episode, I tried to pin him down a bit more onto some of the specifics that Animoca is involved with, notably the Mochaverse, the sandbox, things like that. As ever, Yat had other things in mind. He's a real visionary for the space. He's someone who has a very deep philosophical idea of what blockchain is about, what decentralization is about, what that means to us as individuals, what that means to us as gamers. So as I try to sort of put him in various boxes, he sort of overflows, and we have I thought a really great conversation. Really loved it. So I hope you enjoyed it too. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Every week we are pumping out new episodes for what's going on in the space. So I hope you enjoy this one, and see you next time. So welcome to the show. Very pleased for the third time that we have a Yat Su, who is the chairman of Animoca Brands, as I'm sure everyone knows. How's it going, Yat?
Very good. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Cool. And so the previous podcast was number 124, which was about 13 months ago, so a year ago. Different, very, very different times. So we were really unpicking the bones of 2022 then, and looking forward to
2023. We're still around. We're still here.
Just about, yeah. But I thought what was interesting, and this is something you've been very good at, and actually quite recently you wrote a sort of piece citing John Locke, the sort of famous English philosopher, and it was called The Labour of Our Times, The Work of Our Work of Our Minds. It was sort of quite a deep piece. I really liked it, about thinking about how, you know, in the sort of Industrial Revolution, people were thinking about, you know, individuality and how you own stuff, and it's the deep philosophical aspects of it. And then you were bringing that to blockchain, which is great. We all love that sort of stuff. And now meme coins are going through the roof. So how do you combine these two, this very deep philosophical thing about the work of our hands and our minds, and then Pepe's like a $1 billion valuation? I mean, that's not the work of anyone's mind, is it? I mean,
I would actually in this sense, I would probably slightly disagree with the notion that, you know, meme coins are not the work of our minds, because I think they very much are the work of our minds, in the sense that they are our stories and our culture. And by the way, we may think of them as ridiculous, but, you know, in one form or the other. But if, you know, someone beamed out from sort of, you know, an alien came to planet Earth, and they would basically look at a Gucci bag or a Louis Vuitton, and they would say, why is this bag worth so much more than, you know, your backpack over there? And he would be equally puzzled. And it comes from the fact that he doesn't understand the culture in which it was born in, right? Because context matters, right? So in the same way that we ascribe, you know, in some ways ridiculous value against things that mean something to us, basically, you know, and I think when I was writing this, obviously, I think, you know, we're both kind of fans of Locke and the general sort of philosophical construct of, you know, ownership and what it all means and the liberties attached to it, is that we are free to create our own stories. And therefore, we are free to create our own narratives as we see fit. I think when we see what happened with GameStop, you know, in a share market perspective, that was a little bit of that as well, right? It was kind of the inkling of, you know, really it was meme stocks, but it's still the same idea. It was like, you know what? Screw the establishment. We're going to tell our own story. This is what we're about. And holding the share or token or whatever it is our story, is our community, is our collective. Now, we can probably argue that many of the meme coins may not necessarily have a stronger culture than others, right? I mean, it's, and I think of it as a little bit as like America as well. Like there's America, the democratic institution, right? And there's the meaning behind what it all is, and it resists all sorts of change. And then there's many, many countries in the world, including European ones, that have said, you know what? We're going to copy what America has done. We're going to take that culture and move it into our countries. You know, and they tried it in Africa, and they tried it in Asia. And you know what? In some places it worked, and in many places it didn't work. Right, the kind of sort of disruptive, chaotic energy that kind of only seems to work in the American democratic institution. Somehow they seem to, knock on wood, you know, who knows about the next term, right? But, you know, like they seem to be able to survive these heavily disruptive, crazy changes around creating really ultimately still, you know, the most powerful economy and country in the world. Whereas others who have emulated that have failed. And so I think meme tokens are the same. So, you know, maybe Pepe is you know, and Shiba and, you know, Doge,
yeah.
maybe those are the yeah. ones that can sort of, you know, stand the test of time because they've got the broader story alignment. And then all the other pretenders, who knows where they're going to be, but people are basically playing around them with the same mindset, but whether they succeed or not is anyone's guess, right? So I do think they are the work of our minds, very much so. And they're owned by the community itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's taking it to the extreme, which is the point of the argument. I mean, I often bore people saying it's a feature, not a bug. And I don't own meme coins. I'm not a meme coin sort of guy, but I, you know, entirely agree with you. The fact that someone created a meme coin called Doge and basically said, "I've made this up. It's worth nothing," and then gave it all away, and now it's a top 10 crypto. It's sort of people creating a narrative about they didn't even create it. You know, they didn't even write the code. I mean, the code was
spoiled. Correct. Anyway, I suppose. Exactly.
So,
yeah.
So that's the perfect example. Cool. In a way.
It is. And, you know, if you really go down at the root of it all, you know, what is money itself? I mean, money is a story that we tell ourselves, right? I mean, it's a fiction that we told ourselves that we agree as a consensus, as a community to say, I give you £1 or $10 or €5.
Yeah.
And for that, I receive some good or service, right? And there's some underlying promise that's attached to it. But the problem is that promise is pretty flimsy if you think about it, right?
Yeah.
At base. I mean, you know, if everyone starts to have a run at the bank, that's it for money. So basically, you know, so again, money in itself is a social construct and is actually, you know, I guess very much, you know, the work of our minds as well. The difference though is that it's actually the work of others that have told us the story. Whereas I think meme tokens and tokens in Web3 are actually stories we get to tell ourselves, right? You know, I mean, whether it's a sand token or an ape coin, you know, there are still stories we're telling people around why you should have it, why it's valuable to you, why it's interesting to you, and what it means to you, right? You know, whether one succeeds more than the other is kind of like which book sells better, which movie series is more successful, you know, which culture is more appealing to you.
No, absolutely. Interesting. Cool. So we'll see where we end up. We'll probably end up a bit philosophical because that's the way our minds work. But I thought after last time, which we were quite philosophical, I thought I'd try really and unpick a little bit about Animoca, because obviously sort of Animoca is as a company that you founded, you know, I don't know, 20 years ago now, doing mobile games back in the day, and now it's become this very sort of force of nature in blockchain, almost like an accidental sort of maybe you feel it's very deliberate, but serendipitous sort of you know, you've invested in, I can't remember what it is, over 400 mainly sort of consumer facing web3 companies, and obviously you have your own projects as well. But I thought some of the game stuff would be good to sort of pick through. So I guess you're best known for Mockiverse at the moment, which is, again, to use your term, did seem very serendipitous in the sense that you wanted to bring something, you wanted to sort of have a network around these companies that you'd invested in, and that's very hard to do from a top-down point of view. So you sort of came up with these NFTs, and my feeling on the sort of outside looking in was that the team were just quite surprised about how everyone suddenly, you know, it wasn't the artwork, it was the story that you told about it, and everyone was like, yes, we really like this story, and it sort of snowballed in a positive way quite quickly. Is that sort of how it worked internally?
Yeah, so I think, maybe it's worth talking a little bit about, you know, I guess the philosophy of Animoca Brands.
Yeah.
Because I think the idea of, you know, we may have discussed this earlier, but the idea of why are we investing in over 450 companies and continuing to invest? Yeah. I mean, even during the bear market, we made continuous investments in space to grow the space. And that's because we do very heavily believe in this idea of a shared network in Web3. And so this is where, you know, in the principles, we think that we're building a shared network, which means that, you know, sort of, I guess it's kind of like sort of rising tide lifts all boats type of idea. And the second thing is that we think as a result of that, Web3 is inherently anti-monopolistic, meaning that you can't actually win as a monopoly in Web3. It's not possible, right? Now, it's kind of like saying, can you be a monopoly in open source? And the argument is, I would say, no, you cannot. I mean, at the end of the day, even if you could have GitLab and GitHub and centers in which open source is put around, these are service providers. These are, to me, you know, they represent almost like the marketplaces of Web3, right? But the actual code that's built in there, that's decentralized. It's owned by the community. And value builds on top of value. The difference, though, is that in Web1, it's a barter trade. It's a barter of our data. It's a barter of our knowledge. It's a barter of our, you know, code. But in Web3, we can now enumerate these with value in the form of money or assets, right? Because of the fact that we have ownership and there's a value construct. So as a result of that, that means that, you know, if it's anti-monopolistic, as we've seen with OpenSea or what we've seen with exchanges and all that kind of stuff, then, you know, we can't really sort of help grow the space by backing the one big company. So instead, okay, we have to back the entire ecosystem. We have to invest in over 150 games and NFT marketplaces. And when we decided on that strategy, which was deliberate, right, in comparison to, say, entering the space was accidental with CryptoKitties. We're like, oh, wow, this is amazing. We should do something. However, you know, when we started to understand it better about the fact that there's digital property rights attached to it and there's a freedom to our ownership of this, well, if, you know, and similar to the article I wrote, if, you know, the center of that attention becomes a user at the end of the day, because a user holds the power, then by definition, you know, there can't be a platform that rules over us. Therefore, how do you sort of, you know, grow an ecosystem and actually hopefully succeed in an ecosystem? It can't be to create walls. It has to be as open as possible. So that's why we've invested in all these companies. But of course, like the problem we had in Web 1, when it was very decentralized with information and data, we needed Web 2 platforms to organize that data for us, because, you know, it was chaos. And so we actually willingly gave our information and data to the likes of Facebook and Amazon and Google and so on, because they put order in this, right? So now we're obviously not trying to do that, but we're trying to say, okay, so how can you create a sense of order and sort of, you know, participation in a decentralized manner, however? And this is where Mochaverse was born, right? The idea that, you know, I own a Mochaverse NFT, and now with Mocha ID, which is the extension of that, where I have sovereign ownership over the assets, which gives me a growth of my reputation in the network, a validation of who I am, governance rights, like with ApeCoin and that kind of stuff, and a variety of other things in the network with proof that I can do today that I couldn't do before in a decentralized manner. And that's really the idea behind Mochaverse. And I think the birth start was, if you remember, the Mint was really given to people who were participants in the Mochaverse or in the Animoca ecosystem. Either you held some of our tokens, or you were a portfolio company, or you worked for one of our businesses. Like, those are the one, that's how you got it, right? And I think this is the, you know, as you know, the Mint price was low, to actually zero in some cases, in terms of the first one, and the second one was, you know, a small Mint price. But the main thesis behind this was, well, if we're going to build a community as the ground up that's based on what we sort of helped set up at start, then we should give it to them and help them build it for us. And that's exactly what happened with Mochaverse. And I think it's a great sort of example of what happens when you create the right type of distribution in terms of participation, rather than necessarily either going for the highest bidder, which of course gives you revenue, but then you're dealing with an owner and holder that has different expectations. So the flip side is that Mochaverse has risen in value, but you will notice very few NFTs are actually on sale, right? Like, because most of the people who are holding it are actually owners, builders, you know, the type of people who we're trying to attract, versus maybe some NFT collections that have much more liquidity, but also they're held by a more degen community that actually trading. And you kind of need both, right? So I think for Mochaverse, we probably went maybe a little bit too far on the builder side, where a lot of the degens in the space were like, well, you know, this is kind of sort of past now, so I'll move on to sort of greener pastures type of thing, partially because of the fact that we were so centered around that. And you need both. I think, you know, companies like SkyMavis have demonstrated with Axie Infinity, you know, and Ronin, of course, that you need a healthy mix of, you know, both to create a market.
Would you like to put some numbers around what a healthy mix of degens and non-degens is? Because I think this is something. You first.
Yes. I would say 80-20 is not a bad mix.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe 90-10. But it's I think the speculative aspect should be the minority, but in terms of power, they probably represent 80% of the liquidity, right? But just imagine if you have 80% that are there that are speculating in the space. Well, you'll have, of course, natural sort of, you know, game theory applying, which means that as a result, you have, you know, very aggressive price pumps that go up and down as a result. But then I think what happens in that environment, you're actually creating a casino inadvertently, right? I don't think people are necessarily out there intentionally saying we're going to do this. But when you have 80% of speculative activity in, you know, it doesn't matter if it's a token or if it's an NFT, right? Then actually you're creating basically an environment where people are basically playing against each other, which again gives it volume. But on the other hand, it might not be the sort of volatile environment you want to have for your gamer. Because in our case, we're trying to create an environment where Web2 gamers can go into Web3 games, can experience the benefit of the liquidity, can experience the benefit of what ownership means without necessarily having to sort of deal with the hyper-speculative nature, which is kind of what happened in 21 and early 22, right? So we're still trying to find the balance. I think all of us are.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's while there's certain levers you have control over, that, you know, one of the points, again, goes back to the sort of feature bug is you obviously don't have control over people coming in for a live asset. Then if someone wants to come in and buy up 100 Mockiverse things to do some sort of weird trading thing, then those are the kicks.
The market. And I think the big difference around Web3 is that the successful projects react to the market in real time and recognize that the market is a feature of what they do, not a bug.
Yeah.
I think a lot of, traditional Web2 game companies that move into Web3 treat the market like a bug, like literally a bug. Mm. Right? It shouldn't be like this. This is not what we want. Mm. We'll reject it. We don't want it. Mm. I don't think that works, right? I mean, if you want to build North Korea, go ahead, right? You know, then you don't open. You have a market, right? But then why are you in Web3 to begin with? I mean, there's no point being in Web3 if you're building a closed ecosystem.
Absolutely. Cool. Continuing with sort of Mockiverse, what's been interesting to see is you've had, you know, as we said, it's sort of a network and it's a sort of an open network. And I guess we start to see sort of games and other projects mainly, but I'm focused on games. So games are starting to sort of integrate with it. And I guess they're sort of coming to you. And then I guess Pixels is the sort of big one. And that's, you know, notable because Pixels has obviously been, is now the most popular blockchain game in terms of on-chain activity by a long shot. It's about 300,000 DAUs. I guess you would say, well, it's working. That's the great example. Pixels was an interesting game on a new blockchain, and we bought, you know, I don't know how many people Mockiverse bought into it, but you know,
it's about a third of the traffic came in from
really?
Mockiverse. Yeah. Okay. Cool. So I think it just demonstrates basically like the way that we think of Mockiverse as well is, how do you tie in to our community of holders of Mockiverse NFTs and Mocha ID? You know, what happens when Animoca makes an investment? So Pixels, you know, I mean, people may not remember, but we were, you know, one of the key investors back in 2021, right? Like early days, right? And so, you know, by being an investor, we not only sort of helping them launch the project and, you know, help them sort of go through all the activities and help them drive customers, kind of almost like a publisher in some ways, but, you know, more like a partner publisher. Not like a publisher in the classic sense. But at the same time, you know, think of the fact that, you know, we've invested in over 150 games. So if you're a Mockiverse NFT holder, you're basically looking at all of the other titles we invested in. And you might say, you know what, how do I get to support this? So you can think of the entire employment cycles and the entire sort of opportunities that start to develop simply because of the fact that we make these investments that then basically can help funnel the activity into Mockiverse, which is a sort of benefit that goes both sides, because we're driving traffic from our users to them, and likewise they get rewards for basically participating and doing this, whether this is beta testing, play testing, activations, spending, doesn't really matter. I mean, you know, in the Web2 gaming business, the traditional mobile gaming business, we do this all the time. There's only one issue. The money goes one way and it never comes back, right? I mean, you pay Apple, Google, Facebook, all this marketing. You pay test companies to basically bring in, I don't know, thousands of people to play test your game, right? But, you know, none of them actually become your customers. And money is a one-way ticket to nowhere. And then hopefully, you know, you get featured by the App Store and, you know, voila, you have, you know, a quasi-hit. And this used to work a lot better when the market wasn't as competitive and as mature. Mm. And now it's almost impossible for an indie game developer to succeed. The way I think of this is, you know, like, you know, sort of tens of billions of dollars, as you know, are spent in CPA, CPI ads in traditional gaming. And all of that basically never goes back to the gaming industry. Never mind the 30% tax that Apple and Google and Steam and those guys charge. Imagine what happens if those tens of billions of dollars actually goes into the hands of the very players who would actually play test the game. Yeah. Not only would probably more of them spend money in the game, right? Like, you know, what we saw with Pixels or what we saw with, you know, Sandbox, that kind of stuff. You would also, even if they didn't spend money in your game, they will probably take that money and spend it in someone else's game, right? Because it goes directly into the hands of the gamer. Whereas the platforms, they take the tax and then they put it in a bank account in Ireland and basically accrue interest. I mean, literally, that's what happens, right? Yeah. The top 13 companies in the world, of which I think only one is not in tech, have $1 trillion of cash I mean, that's insane if you think about it, right? And that's unproductive cash, by the way, right? That's not what capitalism is supposed to be about. And I think the other thing is, and this is kind of where it goes back to the first principle of, you know, when you build in a shared network, by us investing in the ecosystem, we're furthering the ecosystem, we're participating in the ecosystem, but we're also laying essentially the foundation of our access for our community. So, you know, in the Web2 model, it was, I'm the app store, I have users. If you want to come, you've got to take our terms, right? And I will rent you basically, you know, the services for that, right? Now, just imagine what happens if Apple also said, and by the way, we might invest in you. Imagine, you know, what the App Store ecosystem would be like if Apple took 10% of their cash, which is $16 billion, and became a VC in seed startups of people making apps. Well, first of all, the app ecosystem would flourish because it'd be new capital. People would be excited. All the indie game developers would be like, yay, Apple, let's go do stuff. Right? I mean, it would be just amazing. Plus, it would probably be the biggest seed fund in history. Right? I mean, it would be nothing bigger. It's bigger than A16Z. It's bigger than us, of course. It's bigger than Sequoia, like all these VCs put together. Right? And all of the game developers would be very happy to pay 30% because there's value coming back. And even companies like Epic, they might even have to say, you know what? I will pay 30% because I know that some of that money is going back and furthering the ecosystem. It's kind of like government, right? If I'm paying more taxes, well, where's my social services for it, right? And the problem about the platforms is they're taxing us and actually not giving anything back in return. And I think this is how things are different in Web3. I think in Web3, to succeed in a space, you have to reinvest back in the ecosystem. Because, you know, if Apple actually became an investor in all of the apps that were successful in the App Store, which is very likely they would know, because after all, it's their ecosystem. Yeah. They would probably have higher returns than the cash sitting in Ireland. So I think, and that's kind of the lens that we take, right? We think that, you know, we need to reinvest in the ecosystem. It gives us access. We can probably get benefits to the Mochaverse community as a result, but also we're further in the space. And also they're willing to work with us because we're putting back money into the ecosystem, right? We're not extracting in this way. We're not saying that we shouldn't be profitable, you know, and have a sustainable business. But the level of extraction is the problem we have broadly in the world today. And I think Web3 solves that.
Okay. Just a little bit of a tangent. So when I thought about blockchain games, this is going to be a tangent. When I thought about blockchain games in general, and this is a continuation of what we've sort of seen, which is a winner-takes-all scenario. So I obviously broadly agree with your sort of thesis that when things are open, you don't have monopolies, and in that sort of technological monopolistic sense. But I do think that economies are sort of monopolistic. So my view has always been, maybe it is another 10 years, that the biggest blockchain games are the ones that are going to have the biggest and the deepest economies, the most liquidity. And so while I think blockchain could be very interesting for sort of neat, very profitable but niche games that are just not going to grow because of the type of game they are. And blockchain will allow that in a much better way than what we've seen previously. But I've always sort of seen it that I think there's going to be a handful of very, very large trillion-dollar economies. And just because of the economic sort of gravity of those games, it's going to be very hard. There's not going to be a lot in the middle. So clearly, I mean, you're not investing on that thesis because you're investing across everything that you want.
Yes, exactly.
But if you can take that mindset away, I mean, is that part of sort of, you know, economic? I mean, you can look at America as a, you know, 10 years ago, everyone was like, well, China's going to take over America, and America's just sort of powering ahead, and China's, you know, at the moment, not, you know. Yeah, so maybe there is something about, you know, just massive economies just by dint of their own gravity just get bigger. So we'll have a couple of massive games. Doesn't really matter what the game is, what genre is, it'll probably have all sorts of different games in there, but there'll be a massive, you know, there'll be a few really big blockchain games.
Yeah. So obviously I would disagree with this thesis, but the point that, but I think the main reason, and you know, outside of the fact that I think it would be pretty sad if we, at the end, we ended up having an oligopolistic type of, you know, blockchain gaming environment, is I think inherently because we have the freedom of our own assets, as in we are really able to move them from place to place, that actually it forces the networks to be as good as possible to the end user at the end. And I think they become harder to do so when you become too large as a scale.
Okay.
Like, I'm not saying you can't sort of appeal to millions of customers, but I think as we've seen with human nature, we actually have a preference to actually sort of, you know, have multiple fashion brands and have multiple gaming experiences and multiple other things. The only issue that we've had in the past is we couldn't really properly sustain them. And because we can shift liquidity from place to place, and because it's Web3, the customer is actually broadly available to you, you can always do vampiric attacks. So I think OpenSea is a great example of that, right? I mean, OpenSea, by the way, could have always maintained their leadership if they had done right, I think, to the community. You know, if they had enforced royalty rights, for instance, they would have maintained a certain set of community. And, you know, they're still the number two player, but, you know, Magic Eden is coming up pretty close,
not
right?
Anymore.
You know? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. And well, no, I mean, Blur, obviously, liquidity is number one, right? But my point on this is that, you know, because the customer base is not sort of stuck with OpenSea, and that's true basically for anything on DeFi, including blockchain gaming, you can actually give rewards to anyone to say, you know what, if you've got a bunch of Axies, I'll give you this benefit because I think my game is more fun than Axie. Now, Axie's response is not going to be, or shouldn't be, well, everyone who uses that game, we're going to ban your account. I mean, you could do that, right? But that would basically create sort of the opposite effect because it actually diminishes your property rights. It takes away your sort of, you know, what is yours. Mm. Instead, the reaction should be the competitive one, which is, say, oh, okay, he's doing this. Well, I'm going to do this, right? And it furthers innovation, right? I mean, we all know that monopolies are actually the death of innovation. And I think this is the point. In Web3, we're creating this sort of capitalist framework, which is open and one where you can't have monopolies easily form. And again, I separate centralized exchanges because by definition, that customer data is essentially locked, right? And so when we talk about Mocha ID, the vision behind that is that ID is yours. You're building your reputation. Once you have a Mocha ID so bound into your wallet, actually, it's yours. We can't take it away from you. Even if we said, you know what, we don't like you and you can no longer, you know, access this game or the other. The thing is, your reputation stays intact. You're an addressable customer, right? You're someone that someone says, well, you know what, you have, $1 million worth of assets or you've played games, you're really good at first-person shooters. I can see it from your status. Let me go after you. I mean, you know, if Apex Legends and PUBG and Fortnite and, you know, Call of Duty had their customers' data openly available to others to address, to give them value, I think we'd have a completely different gaming market, sphere today. I don't think it would look anything like it is right now.
Cool. Okay, good. So that was a little move on that. I'm not sure I agree with you, but anyway, we could spin
it up. No, it's fine. I mean, we're early in the space, right? And obviously, we're building towards more decentralization. Hopefully, we're right.
So there was one thing I wanted to just ping past you. You probably can't say much about it. Yeah. So there is Mockaverse. The NFTs are out there. I was actually quite happy that they did a mission with Nine Chronicles, which I've completed already. So that was fine. Retrospective reputation for me there. But there is this sort of mysterious thing in my mind called the Mocha Foundation, which has been sort of floating around for the last couple of months. It sort of occasionally tweets something very like, yes, we all love Web3 or something. You know, it's not very clear to me what it is. When it first came up, I was like, this is definitely a scam. This is someone's playing into Mockaverse's success. And then Mockaverse Twitter retweeted something. So what can you tell us about the Mocha Foundation? And assuming it's not a scam, that'd be a good starting point.
Yeah, it's not a scam. And I think one thing you can definitely tell, and I can't say too much, of course, in the sense that it is a foundation. It is set up in a manner, I think, that is sort of true to the spirit of decentralization. And, you know, we're basically, you know, as Mochaverse have planned to work very closely and do all sorts of things. But that's about all I can say. I mean, the fact that we, as Mochaverse, have retweeted and they have retweeted us, I think says something about the fact that there's a close collaboration. Mm. But I think that's all I can say at this moment in time. Stay tuned, I guess, is what I would say.
But I guess equally, it's sort of come, you know, I guess Mochaverse as an NFT project is fully decentralized, but equally, I think it's interesting for lots of projects where obviously we have a goal of sort of DAOs and decentralized and all this sort of, but you need some scaffolding to get to that point, and that point might take 20 years. I mean, not in this case, but some of these, yeah. At the moment, I think there's no good examples. Yeah, so you do need some, sort of grown-ups.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that you know, a lot of people sometimes would say, oh, you know, ApeCoin, you know, DAO. It was a failure and so on. I actually disagree with that. I mean, at the end of the day, we're still talking about a $2.2 billion DAO, right? High liquidity with probably one of the highest active engagements. I agree that there's many things that could be better. But I would also say that, you know, when you think about the decision-making that's taking place at ApeCoin DAO, the level of information that comes through, the review processes, actually, I would say, it's one of the most, if not the most democratic, certainly NFT culture DAO that's out there, run, you know, by fully elected people. I mean, that's the other thing, right? It's not run by the CEO of a former project that was there in this foundation. I mean, you know, I was part of the original special counsel and I was one of the last ones to stay. And now it's completely decentralized. The people that are in the special counsel, in the working group, were not involved at all in its early days. You know, basically, you know, it's as decentralized as they come, right? And then even if you look broadly at things like Ethereum or Bitcoin, again, these are great examples of you know, I guess, foundational type setups that, you know, or community owned setups that really don't belong to anyone and really owned by the community. And I think this is a feature of Web3 that actually there's a point where the more decentralized you become and the more community owned you really are, actually the more valuable you become. And I think, you know, going back to the earlier comment around meme coins, what makes meme coins so interesting? Yes, again, not all of them will sort of, you know, see the, you know, succeed in the longer run. But because they're community owned and because they are truly, truly decentralized, right? Yeah. The spirit of it, right? Actually, there's a life that just simply doesn't extinguish because the community is the one that keeps it alive or not, right? And in some ways, it's like trusting the community. Say, oh, well, geez, you know, I'm giving it to you. But, you know, imagine what happens if Bitcoin's hash rate was controlled by, like, you know, one miner. Or what happens if, you know, Ethereum actually had, you know, tokens centralized around Vitalik, for instance. There would be, the token would have none of that kind of value that it has today. So there's an interesting correlation, which I haven't analyzed deeply, but there's an interesting correlation between decentralization and value formation and capital formation.
Yeah. I mean, it's always this, if you have a perfectly sort of sensible and well-organized DAO that always does the right thing, then you...
Well, then it wouldn't be democratic to begin with. I think it would...
Then it's sort of a... Yes. You don't need a DAO, do you? I mean, sort of, you could run it by committee anyway. I mean, that's sort of...
Yes,
I guess,
exactly.
Your DAO has to make the decisions.
Yes, and it has to have chaos because I think, you know, the disruptive side of a democratic system is actually what's beautiful about it. You know, imagine, to your point, right? If America, in all its history, was run very smoothly and everything was just happening as planned. We know some economies in the world that work this way and, you know, they're probably not very democratic. So it really depends what you want, right? Pick your pick your poison, as it were.
No, absolutely. And I think it's always sort of, not sort of funny, but it's some of the sort of, in a sense, best critics of sort of blockchain and all that sort of stuff, you know, they have so much material to sort of work with, or like, this stuff doesn't work, but they can never flip the coin and go, but this stuff does work. It's always, you know, you're always like, well, you can always point to the, there's always things going wrong there, and there always will be things going wrong, but if you can't point to the progression that is sort of building that up,
is
the failure is being used to get to this stage here, then you're
correct.
Sort of,
and I think it's, you know, you're resilience of, that's right, and it's a resilience of that failure to come back from that, that's key, right? I mean, the strength of a democratic institution is that it could fail and it can come back from that failure, from that lesson, because it's not fatal, right? And I think Web3, blockchain, absolutely personifies that. I mean, just think about what happens in the last 5 or 6 years, the kind of cataclysmic failures that we've had within our ecosystem. And by the way, no help from the government, thank you very much, right? I mean, it wasn't like, you know, they bailed us out or they came in and did something or whichever. I mean, frankly, quite the opposite in many cases, right? And yet here we are at the point in time where the entire Web3 ecosystem is like $2.5 trillion, right? And, you know, Web3 gaming is basically sort of, you know, starting to rise quite significantly. Metaverse is coming back, and of course, meme coins as well. Yep. The whole space has just demonstrated that actually it is able to learn from these failures and emerge stronger as a result, right? So I think that, to me, that's the test. That's a proof.
Yeah. So we've sort of waylaid this podcast by talking about all the things we're talking about rather than the things I was going to talk about at the start, which is fine. But maybe we can do some quick fire stuff. So I did want to go through some of Animoca's sort of bigger projects and just sort of see where we are with those. Because so I guess the main one I wanted to at least touch on is the sandbox, which has been, at least I think we can say, that has taken a lot longer than people expected. So it's been around since, you know, formed as 2018 as a project. I think there's not a formal live date. I think, you know, end of this year, start of next year sort of thing. I mean, there are things to do live now, so I'm being slightly mischievous on it. But how does the sandbox fit into, you know, where we are now? Is it? I mean,
well, I think it's very tactical. But remember, even things like Roblox and Minecraft took many, many years to actually get to the point where it had this community driver. The difference, though, between Minecraft and Roblox, and in this case, by extension, Sandbox, it is very much driven by user-generated content, right? That's the heart of it. And so it may not necessarily seem like the content is there in comparison to maybe a game that's centered around building one particular game experience, like an Axie or Pixels or Phantom Galaxies or that kind of stuff in comparison to Farcana or, you know, all those type of sort of, let's call it sort of single title focus, at least in its initial. But, you know, when the whole network effects start to form, they form much more rapidly. And today, the number one, number two game in the world is Roblox and Minecraft. And nobody would have necessarily said 10, 15 years ago that these would be the biggest games in the world in comparison to what is a Call of Duty, what is a World of Warcraft, what is a PUBG, what is a Fortnite, right? I mean, most of them would have said those should be the biggest games in the world. And lo and behold, they're not. In fact, Fortnite is saying, oh, you know, that user-generated content stuff, that's kind of cool. Let's bring that into Fortnite, right? You know, with a creator mode. So it's the same. It's the same sort of thing where they're actually taking stuff, you know, from the UGC side. But it takes time to develop it because the network effects to form in them take more time. Sandbox, however, of course, is in a really strong position. The fact that it's built in a voxel model means that it is much more composable than probably any of the other metaverses. I mean, if you build a metaverse, you know, in you know, high fidelity, it's beautiful and it's strong and it's great. But the ability to actually construct freely on top of it, like in the Lego-like ways, is harder. That's also the reason why Sandbox was able to add more sort of, I guess, non-coding style tools in comparison to other ones because of the fact that, you know, you have that flexibility in the interface. So also, at the end of the day, it's something we're familiar with, right? We look at Sandbox and we say, Roblox, Minecraft, we get it, right? It's a social component that I think, you know, will become much more valuable in those networks because, of course, you play games to meet friends, to be with friends, right? And I think, you know, once Sandbox finally gets out of its alpha period, and I think it's all about sort of, you know, the latency and the network efficiency, then I think you have a point where network effects can really continue to build. Because one of the struggles that, you know, happens when a game is not running, you know, permanently is that you can't build network effects on something that has to basically run in seasons, right? It's network effects building and then, okay, cool down. Network is a building and then cool down, right? You want to be able to sort of actually let it actually develop and grow naturally. And I think that's what's missing. But when that happens, I think it's going to be pretty explosive.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. My I've just started playing Roblox with my kids, so I'm starting to get an idea of this. When you have a friend and then you've got... Yeah, I can see now how it would work in the Sandbox way, because there's always different... At the moment, they're mainly branded experiences, but you would want to get your friends
and different game experiences
where your friends are, and exactly. So yeah, it's really really fascinating. Okay,
And by the way, this speaks very much to the classic gaming model. And when you look at Bartle's model, right? Yep. I mean, he does say very clearly that 80% of people who play games play for social reasons. If you actually ask, you know, a person why he's playing Roblox today, there is a very high probability he say because my friends are. He's not necessarily saying because it's the most fun game or whatever. It's where my friends are, right? And I think this is you know, that model applies no different if you're Web 2 or Web 3.
So as I quickly rattle through, so the Rev ecosystem, which is all your racing games, which is you got. I mean, it's quite a lot now. It's sort of surprising when you look through it. I guess sort of learning from the failures, or maybe not a failure. I don't know, but the big game there was the F1. The F1 game.
It's okay. You can call it failures. It is what it is. But I guess that was a more. Fine.
I mean, that was more to do with licensing. So I guess the learning there was more to do with probably expensive licensing rather than anything else.
But it was also a strong lesson, I think, for us in terms of how to, because, you know, the agreement we thought was pretty clear. But at the end of the day, you know, if you don't have consensus with the IP holder and also the market, you know, when we did the deal with F1. That was 2018, 2019. I mean, we were pretty ahead of our time at the time. And so, you know, back then, everyone was like, what's NFTs? Oh, it's a kind of Web3 thing, no blockchain. Okay, let's give that a go, right? And then, you know, our agreement was pretty clear in what we thought. But then, of course, you know, license holders have their ways. And when someone ends up basically going and sort of, you know, having big, big sponsorship deals and someone else says, and by the way, I want those NFTs too, right? Then suddenly you're in the situation where you realize, wait, hold on a second, we don't have ownership and therefore we don't have rights attached, which is the whole point about Web3, right? So that's why we've been generally backing much more what we call, you know, Web3 native projects. Because, you know, whether this is Bored Apes or our own Mochaverse or, you know, Cool Cats or, because these are ones where you own the IP, you have the freedom to do stuff, which, by the way, I think is a really important component to it. You know, we can use brands like MotoGP as a way to promote access. You know, we did this big billboard, got a lot of attention, you know, all that stuff. So that's helpful, right? But I think at core, you know, I would say for Rev ecosystem, you know, which has, you know, I would argue is probably the one where we've had most of our lessons, right? And these lessons are being learned and applied throughout the rest of our ecosystem, but also for Revin itself, right? And, you know, I would say that, you know, the center of our attention when it comes to the NFT collections would be things like Torquies. The Torques are very, very important. The studios know how to make really good games. And now, basically, we're taking those elements of these really high-quality games and bringing them properly into Web3 through the Rev ecosystem, right? But, of course, it was an evolution because, as you might know, bringing people from Web2 to Web3 isn't a straight line. It's not like you go to a traditional Web2 game studio and say, all right, let's do Web3. Everyone says, all right, let's go. Like, they have different ideas of what that means. Because I think, as you might appreciate, when you're in Web3, you're actually in a natural, real economy with a sort of economical belief and structure and system that doesn't exist in Web2. And I think in many Web2 game designers who design game economies fancy themselves as economists when they actually don't know much about money itself. Because they believe they're managing an ecosystem, but it's really not a real one. And and so the principles around this are often lost. And I think we've matured as a space. I know, I think we oversimplified it. And I think to some extent we were guilty of it too, by sort of saying, oh, well, if I know how to make a game economy, I know how to make a token economy. Nothing could be further from the truth, right? You have to, you need to apply sort of much more deeper thought around everything that you're doing. In comparison, right? I mean, you know, that was, you know, years ago. And so we're all learning these lessons and are getting better for it.
Cool. And so final one, which I guess, you know, particularly interesting on your Web 2, Web 3, which is the Tower sort of ecosystem, which is your very successful Web 2 tower defense games, Crazy Defense Heroes, and another one I always forget. And then Crazy Kings, and it's still ongoing. So there is a version of the Web 3 one you can play. But the whole point of that was you were going to give away the tower token to people playing the Web 2 game, and you had some NFTs well, and now there's an NFT game as well. But again, that's one that has taken a while.
I would say Tower is an interesting model. So let me first sort of express that Tower, we never sold any tokens, right? So this was really a fair launch. It was simply, we just simply gave it to the community and said, let's go, let's see what you guys, you know. And if there, you know, arguably, if there was an attempt to create a gaming meme token, maybe Tower sort of was sort of we wouldn't think of it as a meme token, but the spirit of it, which was essentially users own it and do stuff with it, we'll do it. But I think the difference between Tower and versus, I guess, the meme culture, which is what we learned today, is that the Tower community consists primarily of Web2 gamers who had learned about Web3 for the first time. And so it created a different dynamic versus, you know, when you look at meme coins or when you look at Mochaverse or when you look at Bored Apes, actually, those are people from Web3. And so our lesson here, which is what we're applying throughout, and sort of gaming is probably one of those early sort of beneficiaries of that sort of experimentation around it, is bringing in more of the Web3 native folks into the ecosystem because Web3 people are generally financially literate. So this is something that, you know, if you remember the narratives back when we first started talking about blockchain gaming, it's like, make it simple. You never have to know about your wallet. You just go in. It's easy. You know, you're onboarded. But actually what we ended up creating was really another Web2 game that just had some Web3 frameworks. So you created, of course, you know, on-chain traffic and all that stuff. But actually, there was no trading. There was very limited liquidity. Nobody was actually doing Web3 things. Because actually, the Web2 user doesn't know what is a Web3 thing because he's not financially literate. I think we forget sometimes, because we're in a little bubble, that most of the world, even if they have a bank account, don't have a stock portfolio, don't understand investing, don't even understand how money works, right? And so when you add all that together and you recognize that that's actually the vast majority of the world, which means therefore the vast majority of gamers. And then we basically say, you have an asset that could be worth something. And then we act surprised when they say, wow, that looks like a scam. Why would I pay this kind of thing? They don't think of it as something that could be, you know, an asset. Which, by the way, doesn't have to be necessarily valuable, but as an asset, they just think of it as, you know, something that's sort of expendable. They don't value the items the same way as a normal investor does, and I think it's also cultural. Like in Asia, for instance, we look at many things from the lens of investing, whether it has value to us, because that's just how we were brought up. Because, you know, in our parents' generation, we didn't have any of that. I mean, my parents, remember the time of China. When basically, you know, you lost your property any time of the day, depending on who felt like it, right? South Korea's GDP was lower than North Korea 40 years ago, right? So for those people, they're like, well, you know what? Property rights and capitalism, that works. And therefore, everything else around that ecosystem functions. You know, there's a reason why South Korea is, I think, the second largest market when it comes to token trading volume, right? I mean, yeah. I think there is, you know, something yeah. there that speaks to their particular native culture that understands why that's important. Whereas I think in the West, we've gotten very comfortable. You know, yeah. if you own a house, you never fear of losing it, actually. Mm. You know, we never are concerned that our governments, despite all the instability no. in the democratic institutions, sort of go away. Like you might say, okay, there's a new government. You know, oh yeah, maybe Trump gets elected. Maybe Labour Party gets elected. I don't know. But nobody fears that, you know, the yeah. police will turn on them. Nobody fears that the house will get taken away just like that, or that their money gets frozen, right? They don't have those concerns. And so they take these things for granted, which actually are really important. So I think that's the lens, right? I think Web2 gamers who are rejecting basically the sort of NFTs and blockchain, what they're actually rejecting is capitalism inside their digital ecosystems, I think. Mm. You know, the thing that I observe about Western game designers versus, let's call them more Eastern game designers, is that I actually think many of them are quite socialist in their thinking, right? They're very merit-based. They don't think, they're against the idea of, well, if you pay money, then you should have more. But this, or more benefits of some sort. And it doesn't have to necessarily be given a level up. But in real life, it doesn't work this way, right? If you have more money, you can live in a bigger house. If you have more money, you can maybe travel more comfortably. You know, yeah. I mean, these are. But in gaming, it's based on skill. If I happen to have better reflect, sort of, you know, faster in my game. If I have, you know, if I'm more skillful, if I'm younger or something, whatever it is, right? Then I have an advantage. And so this perception of a meritocratic approach, which, by the way, I don't think is meritocratic either, because, you know, if gaming was only ever playable for those who played it well, our gaming industry would not be big. It would be gaming pre-mobile, right? And actually, the biggest innovation that happened in mobile gaming wasn't the fact that, you know, it was handheld, because Game Boy did that way, way before. Yeah. It's the fact that through a swipe of a finger, I became a good gamer too. And so we created a larger accessible ecosystem and expanded the space. Mm. And so I think the next class of people that are entering gaming, for instance, are going to be the capital holders, the ones who don't have the time or maybe the skill to play, but they can participate through ownership, right? I mean, there's still about 3 billion people around the world who are not playing games, but they have access to it. Why are they not playing games? Because every time they actually play a game, they get their ass kicked by people who know how to play better. And they're basically, you know, literally, I mean, they're trolling them, right? That's no fun, right? And so in this sense, I think arguably capital and money is an equalizer that actually creates more of a challenge. So I don't think of it as negative, but I can understand, just like with any ecosystem, that you feel threatened by what you felt was comfortable, and now something else is coming in that might sort of upset that balance. But in Asia, we don't have this problem, which is why the growth is coming from this region for the time being.
Cool. Well, we could go on, but I tried to keep the podcast too long.
I understand.
I tried my best to steer Yat to talk about actual specifics, but Yat did what Yat does best, and we veered off, which is fine. I love that stuff. So
wonderful. Thank you. I always have fun chatting with you. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you so much for your time. We'll have to come back and do another. When you're talking, I throw up so many questions, but we can't go there, so we'll have to wait another year.
Yes, very good. No, thank you so much.
So thanks to you guys for watching, listening, however you are consuming the podcast. We're on a weekly cadence now, so I've done a one every week in 2024. Hope to continue to doing that. I've got a whole bunch of ones stacked up for March. So please subscribe. Don't forget to come back next time, and see you then. Bye-bye.